Last month, an average of more than 1,800 presidential commercials per day aired in Iowa. With billions spent on political advertising this year, how much can you trust the claims you see on TV? To River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, Tim Carr, the author of two recent reports on political ads for Free Press. We'll also check in with Adam Karas, news director for KCRG-TV, about how they're fact-checking ads. And we'll talk with Tom Rosenthal of the Pew Center for Excellence in Journalism about how the sources we turn to for news are changing. First, this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's start off with some statistics that wowed me. I think they'll wow you, too. Last month, in September, an average of more than 1,800 presidential commercials per day, aired in Iowa. Well, with billions being spent on political advertising this year, how much can you trust those claims you see on TV from either camp? Well, that's a central question we want to look at this hour, and joining us first of all to do that, Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy, the author of two recent reports on political ads for Free Press. Welcome to you, Tim Carr.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Remind us, before we go any further, for those who don't know, what is Free Press?
Free Press is a not-for-profit media reform group. We work on media policy issues across the United States, and our goal is to engage the public in policymaking in a way that makes the media more accountable and more democratic and inclusive.
Okay, we want to reach out to our listeners this hour. Tell us what ads you've been seeing with more than 1,800 on average per day flying by our screens. So tell us what you're seeing, what you think of them, and do the claims made by TV ads influence your vote? Or is what is said in a political ad, does that go in one ear and out the other? I want to hear your views, your questions. I'm not asking you that yet, Tim. I'm asking our listeners. We'll see what they have to say. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, Iowa Public Radio, is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. So let's turn to some of the surveys that you've done. Let's talk about these two. In September, Free Press released Left in the Dark. That was an analysis of political advertising and local news coverage in five cities: Charlotte, Cleveland, Las Vegas, Milwaukee, and Tampa. You chose those, I guess, where spending had skyrocketed this year. How much in TV ads will be spent by November 6th? Do you know?
Well, the best estimates put it at more than $3 billion. And as you've mentioned, Iowa is getting a lot of those ads. So are places like Colorado, states like Ohio, Florida. They're focused on battleground states where they think they can shift the population a few degrees, mm-hmm. enough to turn the whole state and the electoral college, the electoral votes of that state, towards one candidate and against another.
What questions do you ask in this particular survey, Left in the Dark?
Well, we were looking at this the flood of political ads, and there has been a lot of analysis about where the money is coming from, the various groups that are raising money, the campaigns that are raising money to buy political ads, but we haven't really looked at where it's going. And overwhelmingly, the majority of that money that goes raised by campaigns and super PACs goes to buying political ads in local television markets. And the local television, despite the rise of the Internet and other media, still remains a very influential medium. So we wanted to see what those ads looked like in some of the markets where ad spending was the highest. And that included Tampa in Florida, Charlotte, North Carolina, Cleveland, Denver, Las Vegas, and see whether what kind of impact those had. And in addition, we also wanted to look at the local television stations, the same stations that were making that are making lots of money by placing these ads, whether their newscasts, their local newscasts, were actually covering the issue. Were they fact-checking some of the ads they air? Were they doing investigative reports that looked at some of these groups, many of which are somewhat hard to put your finger on because their funders often hide behind the names of these groups? Whether they were doing, the local stations were doing investigative reporting that inform their viewers about, you know, mm-hmm. who the people were that were behind a lot of these messages.
Mm-hmm. Right, and we have to remember, for local broadcasters, this is a huge boom in revenue once every 4 years, especially during a general election, isn't it? It's a lot of money.
The spending in 2012 has been unprecedented, and that's for a number of reasons. I mean, it does go up from election to election, but there was a Supreme Court decision in 2010 which allowed corporations to spend unlimited amounts on campaigns. There have been a few court decisions as well that have really opened up the market to political ad spending.
Mm-hmm. So what did you find when you asked these questions with your analysis?
Well, we found in these markets that we're seeing a lot of political ads that there wasn't enough of an antidote in the local news coverage. There weren't any reports, for example, in Cleveland or Milwaukee that actually fact-checked any of the ads that they aired. And in a few instances, we found one instance of fact-checking in Tampa, for example, they, even though they found an ad to be false, for example, they would continue to do business with that advertiser and run those ads. So by and large, there has been a dearth of local reporting to fact-check the ads and investigate the groups behind them. And we've identified that, obviously, as a problem, given that people still watch local television to learn about political news. And if the newscasts aren't doing their job to counter some of the misinformation in these political ads, it could be a problem come election day when people, viewers, turn into voters.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk to one of those, a news director for a local television station in just a moment, but tell us, why do you have any findings, reasons why there is a reluctance among these broadcasters, not here in Iowa? You looked at other cities in the U.S. Any hints as to why local broadcasters, by and large, fail to cover a political ad spending in their markets as a journalistic topic, an issue?
Well, you know, I wish I could tell you that they were more than just hints, because I did follow up and try to call the news directors and general managers of some of these stations, and they wouldn't tell me one way or the other. But there are a few things that could suggest an answer there. One is, obviously, when they are making so much money selling political ads, you would think they might be disinclined to actually go after some of the groups that are buying these ads. So it may be because they don't want to bite the hand that's feeding them.
Mm-hmm.
Another suggestion is that I've heard from other stations is that they don't want to call out these groups for lying. They don't want to reject these ads, and they are entitled to reject ads that are coming from non-candidate groups.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, they are fearful that those groups won't come back and buy additional time. So I've been reaching out to a lot of station directors to try to get the inside story on why they accept ads and don't do the coverage, and that's the closest I've come at this point. These investigations are ongoing. We are going to be releasing additional reports before Election Day.
So let me tell you, Tim Carr, about our experience, an unscientific sort of poll, if you will. Our producer reached out to 9 TV stations in Iowa to ask about their policy on political ads. 2 of the 9 responded by saying the news department had nothing to do with the political ads. 2 responded to say they weren't doing any fact-checking. And we're going to talk with 2 who are in a few minutes. And the rest didn't respond at all. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me. I think that there is an inclination not to scrutinize the money election complex, the money and media election complex, too closely, because it is a very good year for stations. They, again, are all told making billions of dollars in this year, and it's a system that benefits them, and they don't want to change it. And I think, you know, the more light that you shed upon this process, the more inclined you are to say, hey, something's wrong here, this is broken. I mean, there's an inherent, really, conflict of interest when you have news stations that are supposed to be reporting on politics benefiting from these groups that are spending so much money to spread misinformation. And you know, there have been reports that or studies that have looked at political ads. The Annenberg Public Policy Center looked at political ads and found that a majority of them contained deceptive information. So there is another issue there. It's not only making money from political ads, but making money from ads that deceive voters.
Timothy Carr, stay with us, Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press, author of 2 recent reports on political ads. We want to add to our conversation Adam Karas, news director for KCRG-TV. Welcome to our program, Adam.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We wanted to just you were good enough to help us out here. As I just mentioned, we didn't get a lot of help from TV stations. You were willing to help us kind of peel back the curtain and have us talk a little bit about your instance. What is your policy on political ads? To what degree do they have to be true, or to what degree do you even measure that?
There's no official written policy as far as what we will or will not add, but generally speaking, if an ad is outrageous, making some outrageous claims that don't have any basis in fact whatsoever, we will decline those to air those ads.
Mm-hmm. Have you done so this political season?
We have not, the reason behind that isn't, I think you hit on it a little bit there, is a lot of the information isn't so much that it's necessarily a lie or completely wrong, but it is misleading. And there's, when you get into that gray area a little bit, it becomes very politicized. You have a lot of research done on each side that they can back up their claim. But again, that research isn't telling the whole story. And that's where it is important to get some of those fact checks in there. And it's really much more so fact explaining than it is necessarily checking whether it's true or false. But it's explaining what the fact is.
Do you have an example that you could bring up, a concrete example you've seen ads about in our market?
Well, one that that we ended up fact-checking was looking at the claims that came out of the Medicare, the impact to Medicare of the Affordable Care Act, that a lot of Republicans were claiming they had cut $716 billion out of Medicare. And if you do look at the spending, it's true that $716 billion was taken out of it, but it is misleading to say that it was cut, because, again, you're not looking at benefits being cut, but there is the argument on the other side saying if you're cutting that spending, there's a chance that you might lose services or lose providers. So there is, again, it's not so much that it's true or false. It is misleading, though, to say that it was straight-up cut and not give any explanation as to what was cut.
Timothy Carr of Free Press, what do you do in that specific situation? Because we know there most of it, as Adam Kara says, lies in this big gray area, slightly misleading, and pants on fire lies are probably not out there that much, or are they, Timothy Carr?
There is a large number of ads that do fall into that gray area, and I think that as a station, the best you can do is really, as Adam suggests, do as much on-air fact-checking as possible, because as you know, and as your listeners and viewers in Iowa know, that there is this nonstop barrage of political ads every time their local news breaks, and they need to create a larger portion of their news hole for fact checking of these ads, just to provide some antidote. And one thing that's important to note, though, that is that under FCC statute, stations cannot reject ads that come from candidates, from qualified candidates. But what's happened in 2012 is we've seen the emergence of super PACs and other third party groups, these so-called not-for-profit social welfare groups that aren't protected in that way. So stations, if they find an ad from a super PAC to be egregiously false, they are within their rights to reject it.
But not so from a candidate's campaign.
That's right. Candidates' campaigns, that those ads have to be aired regardless of whether they're true or false. That's something that's written into the FCC statutes on this.
I wonder, Adam Karas, if you know how much, what percentage of the ads in this season on your station, KCRG, have been paid for by the campaigns and those paid for by these outside groups like super PACs?
I would say the majority are being bought by PACs right now, but it is closer to 50-50 than you might expect. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't have the numbers directly in front of me, but it's fairly close to 50-50, but the PACs are contributing a huge expense to it. And you really can't tell the difference. There's just been a surge in ads this year, and the PACs are a big reason behind it. Comparing to 2008, for a five-week period, from basically August 27th to October 5th, we had about 948 ads run in that time frame. This year, we've had over 2,000 run in that time frame. Mm-hmm. So it is a huge ramp up. And when you talk about fact checking, that's one of the problems that we're encountering, and maybe why a lot of stations might shy away from it. It's overwhelming to an extent, how many ads are out there.
What obligation do you feel as a TV newscaster broadcaster in fact-checking these ads, and I guess you're limited to the ones that come from outside groups.
Well, and you can check the ones from candidates as well, because again, there's some of those claims that are in that gray area will work their way in there. But it is there is that obligation. I think if you're a TV journalist, you have that obligation to explain what you're putting on your air, because as Tim mentioned, you do have to air all the ads from political candidates, and so you are putting those ads out there. So it's worthwhile to explain it. But because there are so many of them, and so many claims made within them, it can be overwhelming. And to be honest, we've done some fact checking, but I wish we'd be able to do more. But when you look at so many ads and the limited resources that local stations have, as far as reporters and time to be able to fact check, because it's not so much the time on the air, it's the time off the air of researching, of contacting sources to put in, that really just becomes a drain to do that full time on all these ads that are out there.
Adam and Tim, hang on. I want to introduce Kara Mashek. She's a reporter for KWWL. Welcome to our conversation, Kara. Let me click you on here. Hi.
I'm glad to be here with you, Ben.
Now, we've got a few minutes before we have to take a break, but I understand you did a piece last week on a series of ads running across Iowa targeting some senators who voted for the iJobs bill. Tell us the story. Which race did you focus on and why these ads?
That's correct. There's a couple of them, actually, both for Iowa Senate Districts 28 as well as for District 48. They look like almost identical ads, but representing, you know, two different candidates and two different Senate races. And I was just, you know, the average viewer at home sitting on my couch and said, this doesn't seem quite right. So I decided to take a little bit of time away and sort of do some fact-checking on my own about it. And sure enough, there were some claims that didn't quite hold up when I started looking into it.
For instance?
There was the iJobs funding specifically is what is targeted in the ad, as you mentioned. The two specific claims that these Senate races specifically bring out are, A, that $1 billion was put in debt for the state of Iowa for the program. When you look at that on the surface, it is basically true. $1 billion is the amount of debt service that the state of Iowa issued to pay for the iJobs program back in 2010. The second little factoid that does raise a bit of a flag is the claim that this program would cost the average taxpayer $1,000, and that just to me didn't seem right. And indeed, there is a report that came out from the nonpartisan Iowa Legislative Services Agency that explains the iJobs debt service, that $1 billion, is actually being paid back by casino revenue to the tune of about $55 million a year, which is a very small portion of the casino revenue that's generated in the state and does not put a burden on the individual taxpayer or taxpayer family.
So it's whether you decide that those casino revenues, are they taxpayer money or aren't they? I mean,
exactly.
The taxpayers are the ones going to the casinos. But if you don't ever go to a casino, you don't bear any of this $1 billion burden, do you?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. So what conclusion did you come up with, Kara, that you present this and then I guess viewers, readers can decide for themselves where the truth lies?
Ultimately, that's kind of where all of these things lie. Our job is to, you know, do those fact-checking measures and see what we can find out, what truth any message that's being put out to the public, you know, bears. But ultimately, it's the person that walks into that voting booth between now and November the 6th that's going to decide which candidate they like and if they believe the messages they're putting out to the public.
Mm-hmm. Did you get any reaction from the campaigns? From viewers
I did,
to this?
Actually. Yeah. One of the individuals who was running one of these ads, I contacted him, and he was willing to sit down and do an interview with me. And he said, this is his quote, whether you want to split hairs on it, this is gambling revenues or other types of taxes, it's still revenue that's coming into the state and is being diverted away from other activities that is instead being used to pay down this debt. So he's pretty defensive about the ad in general, but said he still believes that he stands by the claim that was made in the ad, whether or not you want to split hairs on that. Mm-hmm. He said it's kind of up to the individual voter that views this message.
Any reaction from viewers worth mentioning?
Didn't in particular to the story that I ran, mm-hmm. but we have received some comments just on web traffic, and people are saying, you know, thanks for doing this. They do appreciate when you come in and present the facts in a so to speak, nonpartisan way and get responses from the people that are putting these messages out there to say what is true, what's not true, because this is ultimately a piece. Maybe it's a small piece, but it is a piece of how I make my decision.
Okay. Timothy Carr, please respond to this email from Eric, one of our listeners in Iowa City. He writes, I think it's not so much an ad sales conflict of interest issue, but instead I think it's a corporate ownership of news stations. Their budgets are so tight and formulas so scripted, they have to have the brains on staff to do the serious journalistic analysis. They have to stick to community, crime, and weather because they can afford to do little else. What do you think about that, Tim?
Well, I know that the news hole is somewhat limited there, and that stations have been laying off journalists over the last couple of years. However, the good news about political ad spending is that a lot of that money is going to station owners. It's going to a lot of the media groups that own broadcast stations around the country, and the hope would be that they would invest some of that new revenue in this kind of political fact-checking. These stations are not going poor by any stretch of the imagination in 2012, and it's incumbent upon them as part of their broadcast license to give back to the community. They sign on to certain public interest obligations mm-hmm. in exchange for use of our public airwaves.
Adam, what do you think about that email from Eric in Iowa City?
I think that's it's got a little bit of correct about it. I think the one thing, when you look at the spending this year, and yes, stations are getting a lot of money this year, but there is a lot of nerves as far as what happens next year when all that money goes away. So there is a little bit of planning there. So it's not a case of the money comes in and we can just automatically invest it. There is some planning that needs to go into future years and how we're going to be budgeted out for years to come. But the resources I mentioned before is a big part of it. The fact that we have the same number of newscasts with fewer employees than we did 10, 15, 20 years ago even, fact-checking takes a big chunk of time, and it doesn't take up the it's more so the time outside. You heard Kara say she had to come in and do some of the research on her own on her off time, mm-hmm. And that's really some of the investment. And stations really need to, if they're going to do fact checking, make a commitment to do it and to do it right.
Let's go to Lona quickly before we have to take a break. Lona in Des Moines. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Quickly before we break, what's your question or your comment?
Well, my comment is that I basically don't pay any attention to any of the ads. I think advertising is condescending and belittles the audience, and political advertising is the worst of all.
Okay.
I've already voted.
Lona, thank you very much. Before we go to the break, Tim Carr of Free Press, do you know anything about that, the research on that? How much of an impact political ads on TV have? Does it go in one ear and out the other?
It's possible that it does. However, it is still where most of that money is spent. The Pew, which is an organization that studies the media, has surveyed the American public, and still majority say that they get the majority of their news and information from watching local television. So a lot of the advertisers are going in that same direction. Now,
okay.
We'll probably know better after the end of this year whether or not people actually took all these ads seriously.
Timothy Carr, stay with us of Free Press, and you led right into our next segment. We're going to be talking with the director of the Center for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center when we come back. Adam Karas and Kara Maschek, thank you very much, both of you, for joining us this half hour. We'll say goodbye to you two. Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about political ads, but we'll also talk with Tom Rosenthal of the Pew Center about how the sources we turn to for news are changing. And you can join our conversation. What do the billions in political advertising make you think about the way we campaign in this country and elect people? Do the claims made by TV ads influence your vote? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a few minutes with more of River to River. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, 2 weeks out from our election day, approximately, the few hours, counting down the last few hours to the last presidential debate of the 2012 election cycle. Maybe you're saying to yourself, when will it all end? It can't end soon enough. Well, political junkies tomorrow will have analysis of the final debate. Clay Masters, my colleague, will be in the host chair tomorrow for analysis of that final presidential debate to be held tonight. This hour, we're examining a couple of aspects of this campaign season, how the billions in political ads on TV are affecting this campaign, and to what degree any fact-checking goes on by the stations that air them, the stations that are profiting mightily from all the money flowing into this campaign. What was the projection? Over $3 billion. This half hour, we also want to ask, in this rapidly changing media landscape, where do people get their news? And how are social media and the internet changing the nature of the campaign? We want to put that question out to you. Have you tell us where you get your information about the candidates? Where do you get your reliable information from? And what sources do you ignore? How do you use social media during this campaign season? Join us with your question, your observation, your comment, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio also on Facebook and on Twitter. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Continuing with us from the first half hour, Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press. Tim, you're still there, correct?
Yes, I am.
Let's have Tom Rosenthal join us, Director of the Center for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good to be with you.
Great to have with you. Have you with us. Let's talk about a survey by the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism and the Internet and American Life Project. You looked at how people find out information about their local community. What did you look at in particular?
Well, the way that local news is typically asked about is as a category. Where do you go for local news? What we did is we tried to break down local news into specific topics, and we identified 16 specific topics such as weather, traffic, tax news, real estate. And what we found was that the landscape for local news was far more nuanced when you asked about it that way. On 11 of those 16 topics, newspapers were actually the most accessed source. But those 11 tended to be civic news that people didn't look for every day.
For example?
Real estate, taxes, city government. More people, 73% of people, go to watch local television news every week, but they only look to television news for three topics primarily: weather, traffic, and breaking news. So local television has done a very good job of sort of owning the topics that people rely on and need on a regular basis. Newspapers did a very good job of kind of owning the multiplicity of topics, even if some of them are not ones that people want every day. But that's also part of the problem for newspapers, is that many of the topics on which people look to them are things that they don't look for very often.
Mm-hmm. And when we say newspapers, are you saying both on printed page and on screens?
Exactly. When we're trying to isolate source here and not simply platform. And people, when you talk about where do you go for news about a crime in your neighborhood, they know whether they're going to the newspaper website or a different kind of website. They were able to make pretty good distinctions about that.
Your survey also looked at how age influences the sources that we turn to. What can you reveal about that?
Well, you'll be shocked to hear that younger people are more digital. Older people tend to be less digital. And so the demographics here are also inevitable. When you break under 40, the Internet becomes a much more important source. It's also interesting, we did this by geography. And if you live in a small town, you tend to be more legacy media oriented. And if you live in an urban community, you tend to be more connected, more digital. And I think there are two reasons for that. One is there's more connectivity, but also a very large newspaper in a city like Chicago or New York or San Francisco cannot cover a neighborhood. And so you have a digital ecosystem that has come in and become more hyperlocal to fill in. So in a town like Seattle, there are neighborhood websites that are more local than the city newspaper can ever be.
Mm-hmm. I see in your report that most Americans, 69%, say that if their local newspaper no longer existed, it would not have a major impact on their ability to keep up with information and news about their community. What do you read into that?
I think it's hard to ask people about something that hasn't happened. That's a hypothetical. I grew up in California where we had a referendum once on whether people wanted to pay for television, and that referendum was soundly defeated in the 1960s. Well, by the 1990s, the majority of Americans were paying for television, and now the majority who pay over $100 a month. So things can change, and I also think that since people need news, if the print newspaper goes away, the newspaper organization or whatever supplier of news covers those materials won't go away. That information will be provided somehow because there's a demand for it. And I think that the audience infers that. They think, well, I don't read the print newspaper, and this information is available, and I'll get it somehow. It'll still be available.
Timothy Carr of Free Press, what do you think of the landscape that Tom Rosenthal has just described there, of the way we are changing in the way we turn for certain topics to certain places and other topics to other places?
Well, I follow Tom's work very closely because these changing trends are very interesting to us. It's important that everybody have access to news and information. And when you look at the sort of legacy media, in particular the old school over-the-air broadcasting, where people got information free via radio and television, that is shifting, and it's shifting towards a cable television model, which Tom mentioned is much more expensive, and not everybody can afford that, and an internet-based model, which, as Tom also mentioned, is expensive and not accessible to everyone, particularly people in lower-income communities or in rural areas. So as we become more digital as a nation, as we rely on paid TV service and paid internet as a nation, we have to be careful that we're not disenfranchising a lot of the people who cannot afford those new forms of media.
Tim Carr is with us, Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press. Tom Rosenthal, Director of the Center for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, we're also on Facebook. Tweet us at IPR Talk. So let's talk specifically, Tim Carr, about social media, the role they're playing in the 2012 cycle compared to 2008. What can you say about that?
Well, it's been really, really very interesting. And both of the presidential campaigns have invested very much in social media. That's not in the traditional sense. They haven't invested in buying over-the-air political ads, but they've staffed up with people who are constantly online, constantly monitoring things in social media via Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr, and trying to create some sort of momentum there. And we have seen, certainly over the last couple of weeks that we've had the debates, that there have been these so-called memes, these kind of moments where that take over social media. For example, the first debate, there was a meme around Big Bird. Candidate Romney had said that he intended to cut PBS, and even though he loves Big Bird, that's what he would do, and that took off on Twitter. There were 17,000 tweets a minute. There were websites. There were Facebook communities. And in the second debate, we had this meme around another Romney statement around binders full of women. And those things have taken off and really kind of captured the imagination of the Twitter sphere. And I think there's still an open question, though, whether that strategy to try to engage people via social media actually translates into votes. Mm-hmm. There has certainly been a lot of excitement using social media to kind of respond to moments in the campaigns. And it's been a very interesting phenomenon. We still don't really know for sure whether that translates to boots on the ground and, right, and you know, people in polling stations.
Right. That's a very good question. What about the question about the origins of why Big Bird and why women in binders? Did one campaign or the other push those to become very popular, to skyrocket? What can we say about why they skyrocketed so much, Tim Carr?
Well, you know, in fact, the campaigns tried to push other memes in social media. During the second debate, for example, Obama had a moment when he was referring to Romney's tax plan, and he called it a sketchy deal. And at that point, the Obama campaign started using what's called a hashtag in Twitter called Sketchy Deal, and they pushed it out into Twitter. And even the Romney campaign had a had a hashtag called Can't Afford Four More that they tried to push out at the same time. And both of those efforts to engage the social media universe fell flat, whereas the other one, Binders Full of Women, which seemed to be bubble up more organically from social media, took off. So even their best efforts, even staffing up with young, you know, very social media savvy staffers, doesn't seem to always spell success for these.
I think we know something both about the scale and the origin of memes, and there are influencers, key people who have a lot of followers, and there's even software that will follow to see who's the originator of ideas and concepts and tweets that go viral. And there are, it's a different oligarchy, but it's still an oligarchy. There is a handful of people in different realms who have a lot of followers and who speak with a louder megaphone on Twitter. The scale of Twitter overall is fairly limited. 13% of adults in the U.S. are on Twitter. 4% tell us that about 2% tell us that they regularly use Twitter for political news, and another 3% said sometimes, so you're up to 5%. It's not huge. I think there's a paradox to Twitter, which is that many political journalists follow their topic and their beat on Twitter. So the power of Twitter may be for sort of Twitter sphere influencers to influence journalists who then influence a broader audience through fairly traditional media platforms, which is not to say that a campaign is wasting its time here, because things that are new and things that kind of have an energy to them and that you can get a sense of whether the public is responding instantaneously have a real value in politics.
Tom Rosenthal, do we know who originated these particularly successful memes, Big Bird and Binders Full of Women?
I think it is known, but it's not known by me. I don't have that. But, yeah, that's the great thing about Twitter is that everything is recorded, and you can trace. And if you have the what they call the fire hose, you can actually go back and find the original, you know, patient zero for every meme.
Right. It can be known. What about the question that Tim Carr raised about, do we know at this point how that translates, a huge Big Bird social media influx and then women in binders? Do we know that affects any votes at all?
Well, and that's the thing about politics is that, it's a little bit like advertising in general. The old saying about advertising is half your money is wasted. You just don't know which half. And in politics, they don't know what's going to trip the wire. So you have to do everything. And the campaign that loses is the campaign that is slow to react, even in areas where you think it doesn't matter. I think that what we can infer about Twitter is that the people at the late stage of an election, particularly a presidential election, who are still undecided, typically tend to be low-information voters who are not particularly enthralled with politics, but they do vote, and they will flop between parties because they don't have a strong affinity either way.
So low
information voters, as they're called in the
they need, as the name indicates, the label, they don't need much information to flip their vote into one corner.
And they don't have a lot, and they're not heavy consumers of news. It's not very likely that those people, I think, are following political sources on Twitter, because they don't tend to follow political sources in other realms. These people are often best reached with political advertising, because you don't have to look for political advertising. It finds you on Twitter, on Facebook, online. You have to have signed up to follow these folks, or you need to be friends with people who are interested in these topics.
Tim Carr, you wrote, did you want to jump in there on that point?
Well, I mean, just to confirm that, I think, you know, the fact that so much of the money that the campaigns and the super PACs are spending is going towards television ad buys and not so much towards these sort of internet placements, whether it be in Twitter or Facebook or via more traditional, if you can say traditional with regard to the internet banner ads, you know, that bears true, that they are looking to television viewers to connect with those low information voters in that mm-hmm. in that more passive way.
And also, isn't it, I mean, true of the television ad, they can buy a certain number of ads. We've averaged over 1,800 per day in this past month here in Iowa from the presidential campaigns. So that's controllable. And we don't know in the Twitter sphere that's not controllable. So what implications does that have for campaigns' ability to control the message?
I think that campaigns are really concerned about that. I think you're right that they do turn to television ads because a broadcast medium by its very nature is one directional.
Mm-hmm.
And when you open it up to social media, that's where the conversations occur. And oftentimes, a candidate will make what they think is a very strong statement, and then social media will decide that it's not, it's a gaffe, and they'll lose control of it. And so I think that's what's kind of exciting about the times that we're living when people actually can go to social media and have a voice. And I think Tom rightly points out that still is a very small percentage of the voting electorate, but it's only going to grow over time, and it may not have as large an impact in 2012. It'll certainly be more measurable by 2016.
And the other point here is that if let's say you're somebody who just rather watch the football game tonight, you don't want to watch the third debate, or maybe you want to watch the baseball game. I'm very tempted as a San Franciscan to watch the baseball game. So I might not see the Big Bird moment, but my friend who's on Twitter may be influenced by a meme and laugh and even send me something and say, you've got to see this thing, and he sends it in an email or brings me over his computer and he shows me something. Word of mouth, which has got to be the oldest platform for communication, is still also very powerful, and that's also influenced by Twitter and by Facebook and YouTube. So the water cooler, wherever it happens, is still a way to change the conversation. And as Tim says, what's dangerous for a politician about social media, including word of mouth, is that you can't control it. People begin to assign their own meaning to this, and isn't that what makes politics interesting?
Beth in Osceola writes, it's easy for me. I only watch IPTV, Iowa Public Television, World and Create. I read the Des Moines Register cover to cover and some magazines and listen to Iowa Public Radio exclusively. I have no idea what the ads are. As an 80-year-old woman, I choose to be informed without all the noise. Good for you, Beth in Osceola. I wonder, you know, when we have a Twitter explosion, Tom, like we did, like Tim described after the two debates, Big Bird and Women in Binders, is that a story, a journalistic story we should be covering?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the paradoxes or one of kind of the limitations of traditional journalism was that it said it was covering public discourse, but it really covered, for the most part, official discourse. We had a hard time trying to get around the kitchen table, and we invented polling to some extent as a proxy for what people were really thinking. So all of these social media are a new window into different parts of a civic conversation that we really didn't see very well before. But none of them is a vox populi that is representative of the whole public.
Mm-hmm.
And what's great about it is that this conversation is organic. It's in the voice of the people. Polls are in the voice of the pollster who constructs the questions and creates a whole framework that the public then responds to. So it's very indirect, although it's a representative sample. This is very direct, but not representative.
Tim Carr, is that the way you see it?
It is, and I think one of the challenges that's inherent there is that if we do agree that having more voices in the conversation is important, that giving more people a way to access politics and to discuss it with their friends and colleagues, whether they be online or off, is this question of internet access. So we still have a digital divide in this country where there are people who aren't able to access that conversation, not because they're not interested in being on Twitter or Facebook, but because they simply don't have internet access at the level that they should. So I think there are some issues about whether or not we want a more participatory democracy and what role the media plays in that. We do need to empower more people with voices in that discussion. One of the things we should look at is is a question of universal access to high-speed Internet.
Just a few seconds left. Anybody want to play futurist, Tom, and say what will the election of 2016-2020 be like? What are the trends here that will continue?
Well, what's happened to the news media is actually a revenue crisis where advertising is drifting away from older media. And so the march towards digital is just inevitable. And if people are left out, as Tim says, that problem will become even greater. But in 2012, we're going to be it'll be a more digital election than in 2016 than it was in 2012.
Tom Rosenthal, director of the Center for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center, thank you for joining us from your studio there.
My pleasure.
Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press. You've been with us the entire hour. We appreciate your time and your insights, Tim.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.